to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. Today we have researcher James Corbett from The Corbett Report. Hello, James.
Hello, Len. Thank you for having me on. It's good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you for coming on, because I realize that you have your own podcast and your own website. We should make comment about that right now. You want to tell everyone where it is?
Yes. Well, it's CorbettReport.com. That's CorbettReport.com. And that's been the home for my podcast and interviews, videos, articles. There's now thousands of hours of media there on the site that's available for free download on, well, a lot of different issues, including some of the issues that you cover here on Black Op Radio.
Yeah. When I was thinking of doing something about 9/11, I thought, well, there's a host of people I could have on. But I thought, you know, I'd really like to talk to you because I thought you do such really level reasoned research compared to a few other people out there. I think other people have been on and on over the years. I believe I discussed Fletcher Prouty with you on your podcast a couple of years ago, and it was very enjoyable. And I caught your latest one about Alan Dulles, so anything you talk about that era on your podcast, I try to tune in for. But today, I did want to, because it's the anniversary of this Friday coming up of 9/11, I wanted to discuss some of the research you did. And a couple of years ago, you started off with you've been doing good work on it for years, but you did a quick primer for it. You did, I think it was everything you wanted to know about 9/11 in under 5 minutes or 5 minutes, which was really good summation of things that, you know, people had done before, like Loose Change and, you know, the host of documentaries that have been done. But you really cut to the point. I thought maybe we could talk about a few of those things today. So to start with, can you tell me what caught your interest in 9/11 and why you've decided to research it?
Well, 9/11 is more or less the reason that I started the website. So I started the website back in 2007 off of research that I started doing in 2006. And I was one of those people who had avoided looking at the possibility of a conspiracy in 9/11 up until that point, because it was just too outlandish for me to even contemplate. And so I, throughout my life, I think I've always been politically interested and motivated and looking for answers behind the answers that were given. So, for example, I mean, with the JFK assassination, I've always known that that is not the story that we're led to believe about a lone nut. But when it came to 9/11, that just seemed, that was crazy. And that's just what those crazy people talk about. And it wasn't until 2006 that really just a series of everyday events led to me suddenly discovering YouTube. I hadn't seen it before because I didn't have internet in my apartment before that point. And so suddenly I'm on YouTube looking at the types of political videos I'm looking at. And I keep seeing these related videos to various 9/11 related subjects. And out of curiosity, I would click on them and then usually dismiss them as silly. But a few of them managed to catch my attention enough to get me actually trying to verify some of the information in them. And at the point where you start verifying some of these things and you start looking up some of these documents and you find out about something like an Operation Northwoods and you start going down that rabbit hole, once you start that process for yourself, I think for most people, it's generally a snowball. And it certainly was for me. So really within 6 months or so of starting down that rabbit hole, I decided, well, I think I have to start doing something to help spread this information to other people, because I know I didn't know about it before, so I know there are other people who don't. So I made the decision to start the website and got right into it. And so 9/11 was really one of those catalysts and one of the first events that I knew I wanted to really delve into in my work. And that's what I was a large focus of my work for the first few years of the website.
Now, back to that day, did you think there was anything suspicious up at all?
I was quite young and naive at that point. So I was fresh out of university and working in my first job in the real world and working at a property management office in downtown Calgary, Alberta, Canada. So I, on that day itself, I was, I guess, kind of passively secondhand watching the news unfold as I was doing my job. And It was interesting to work in a property management office when that's happening, because they're talking about the World Trade Center and how it came down and things like that, and how, you know, how many square feet it was and all of that, and how many people would have been in there. It was quite a harrowing experience from that side. And then listening to sort of someone had the radio on in one of the offices and listening to the reports, and now the Pentagon's under attack and things like that. It was obviously surreal and crazy, but I guess I was so caught up in all of the things that I was trying to do that day and managing and arranging for alternate travel for people in the office and things like that, that I didn't really have time to even begin to really understand what the narrative was, let alone what the problems in it would have been. So later that evening, obviously, when I went home and I was trying to absorb as much of the news as I could, I was very much caught up. Obviously, by that point, they had just got the sort of the strikes and the collapses of the buildings on well nigh infinite repeat on every major news channel. And I think, of course, that traumatic imagery was used to help shape people's perceptions of the day. And well, here it is. You've seen it happen. These buildings just collapsed. They collapsed. They collapsed. And they keep showing them over and over. So I think I was part of that that massive kind of media psyop that really completed the events of 9/11 in the minds of the public. And I was privy to that. And I think that really shaped my perception of it for a very long time. And like most people, I didn't even know or find out about World Trade Center Building 7 until several years later, until I started looking at 9/11 truth issues. So there's all of those things that I think were quickly swept under the rug that day that I too missed out, like most people, because I was also attempting to just do my job.
Well, the thing that stands out in my mind is that things didn't just clear up that day. I think for the next week, every day, things got weird. You know, like, just when you thought you could maybe understand what was going on, things just got more surreal or unreal, that you go, wow, this is so unbelievable. So, well, I'm going to sign up. We're going after these terrorists. And who would do this? And when you start, I mean, that day, I happened to be lucky enough for someone, or that day or the next day, you know, you talked about the missing money, trillions missing, and we'll get into that in 1 second. But somebody who was in the stock market was telling me, oh my God, they're doing an investigation. This will be the real, you know, this is where they're going to go. I can't believe they said that on CNN, that there was these put options on airline stocks and that. And he said, these guys knew what was going to happen. They knew what was going down. It kind of reminded me of something that Fletcher Prouty had told me about before the Bay of Pigs invasion, that the stock market activity was going crazy over sugarcane stock and other things, meaning that people in the Pentagon knew there might be this invasion of Cuba, and it would be good if they got into the sugarcane business, because they would be freeing all these fields and becoming online, kind of thing, you know? And so that kind of perked my ears up. But yeah, when I couldn't believe that the Pentagon actually got hit by anything. I was just secure in my belief that there were anti-aircraft missiles on the roof, and it would be the most heavily defended building in the world almost. And once you started hearing about that plane crash in Pittsburgh and you know, or Shanksville, whatever, you hear the stories, and it didn't just end, it kind of got more into this twilight zone of, am I believing this? Are you kidding me? That was my reaction. My initial reaction, though, I was, when they started talking about these 19 hijackers and they knew so much about them and all that, it seemed to me that something was up. And I remember that was on a Tuesday. We did, me and Anita did a Black Op radio show on the Thursday. And as we started talking about it, I remember at the end saying, look, I want to make an apology to anyone, but I think there's something weird going on. And the more I look into this, and there's only 2 days, that things are just not right. So I'd like to apologize to any Americans if I'm wrong. I kind of remember saying that. And strangely enough, a few times that people have gone back to my archives, they've said, wow, Len, like right away, you said something's not right about this. They were reporting they found, and it's not Muhammad Atta, it was another terrorist, but they found somebody's passport in the rubble. Right. I mean, the whole thing seemed to be, when those two buildings went down without falling over at all, you know, when they just kind of seemed to be pulverized from the inside and falling, you go, well, this looks, and he said that, right? Peter Jennings, I believe, maybe, said it looks like every other demolition you've ever seen, and you have to destroy the understructure, the basement of a building, to get this to fall down like that, right? And when you're seeing this, but yet people are telling you it's something else, you're right, though, it did take about at least a year for 9/11 truth people like that to get out some of the information that people knew about.
And there were people right there at the beginning, to be fair. There were people who were writing about it on that day that, or a few days afterwards. I remember globalresearch.ca, the Center for Research on Globalization, they started their website, I think, the Sunday before 9/11. And so they were publishing articles basically from that day on. And some of that early work has really stood up as some extremely important work, and unfortunately a lot neglected, including, as you say, talking about the insider trading investigation, which a lot of people think basically was debunked, or, you know, they did an investigation, they didn't find anything. That's actually not quite true. And that's one of the things that I'm addressing in my 14th anniversary coverage, is that, in fact, that's a much bigger story. But you bring up the story of Fletcher Prouty and the Bay of Pigs operation and some trading that took place in relation to that beforehand. It's interesting to think about that in relation to 9/11, because something that most people probably don't know is that the first major national security presidential directive that was signed, that was part of the Bush administration's decision directives, was called NSPD 9, Combating Terrorism. And you can read about this on FAS.org, but it was a strategy that laid out how they were going to eliminate the Al-Qaeda network and target Taliban targets in Afghanistan, including leadership, command control, air defense, ground forces, and logistics. It was basically the invasion plan for Afghanistan. It was sitting ready to be signed on President Bush's desk on September 4th of 2001, 1 week before 9/11 even took place. So I think there were probably people in positions in the Pentagon and related agencies that did have wind of what was coming in one way or another. And it's interesting to look at that possible connection, especially given, of course, now that we know the negotiations that were taking place with the Taliban for the Caspian Sea oil pipeline beforehand, where they were threatened with a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs, depending on what they decided to do with that pipeline. So it is, I mean, all of those facts also add up to the fact that people may not have known exactly what was going to happen or in exact what way, but I think a lot of people did know that an invasion of Afghanistan was on the books and ready to go before the event even took place.
Yeah, a host of things are ready to go. Maybe you should elaborate on that a little bit for people who are not familiar with that. I think that they were flown into Texas, if I'm correct, to meet with George Bush and whoever, whatever cronies were around when they were made an offer.
That's right. Yes, there was representatives of the Taliban were in Texas in the summer before 9/11, and they were negotiating for a pipeline. And off the top of my head, I don't remember the details of who was involved specifically in that meeting, but I do know that they were there, and that a representative of the U.S. administration was told or told the Taliban that we will offer you a carpet of gold or you'll get a carpet of bombs. That was a direct quote from a couple of French authors who wrote a book on Bin Laden, The Forbidden Truth, Jean-Charles Brizard and Guillaume Dasky. And so they did the research about that series of meetings that took place directly before the invasion. So again, I mean, it's just another, I mean, there are many, many bricks in that wall, but that's just another one that reinforces that idea that this was very much planned in advance.
Yeah, this whole idea that these 19 hijackers were really striking out against America. When you hear and read the Operation Northwoods, you really can't believe that a government would put people in such harm's way as then with the Reichstag fire, or, you know, going back to even like the Boston Tea Party, that such a, quote, fraudulent operation would be going. What's the end game here? Do you want to talk a little bit about that, about these hijackers and any research you've done into them?
Well, I think probably more interesting than the hijackers themselves, who really, I mean, again, these are people who were drinking alcohol in restaurants and bars beforehand, involved with cocaine. One of them, I believe, Muhammad Atta himself, living with a pink-haired stripper And yet we're asked to believe that these are people who were so devout in their fundamentalist Muslim beliefs that they were willing to fly planes into buildings, etc. So there's been some very good research out there talking about how they were likely involved in undercover work in regards to drug shipments for the CIA before 9/11, and ultimately got caught up in an operation that they weren't even aware of. And that relates back to the prospect of remote control of the airplanes, which sounds like maybe a science fiction idea to a lot of people. However, it was actually one of those trails that leads back to the Pentagon's comptroller office. At the time of 9/11, the comptroller of the Pentagon was Dov Zakheim, who was previously the CEO of a corporation called SPC International, which provided flight termination systems for the U.S. military. And the company boasted that they could provide a fully redundant turnkey range safety and test system for remote control and flight termination of airborne test vehicles. And this was pre-9/11, as were a lot of the tests that had gone on in controlling even Boeing 727s via remote control. So that was all technology that was in place. And there you have the person in control of the finances of the Pentagon, who was formerly the CEO of a company that actually worked on that. There are other cookie crumbs on that trail that point back to the idea of these planes being remote controlled. But perhaps that's another window into the issue of the financing of an event like this, because Dov Zakheim obviously in control of the finances of the Pentagon at the time when, I think now infamously or increasingly infamously, people might know that just the day before 9/11, Donald Rumsfeld declared a war on bureaucracy, because for some reason or another, the Pentagon accounting systems weren't able to track the flow of $2.3 trillion of funds through the system. And that is a story that really started with a Government Accountability Office report back in 1999. But it started to snowball from there. And in fact, by the time of 9/11, there was another $1.1 trillion in transactions that couldn't have been accounted for. So it was up towards $3.4, $3.5 trillion. And in fact, that number has continued to grow over the years. Now there are $8.5 trillion of transactions that just can't be tracked because of the Pentagon's inadequate accounting software, although they spend $20 billion worth and 2,200 different computer systems designed specifically to track financial activity through the Pentagon, but they just can't keep track of all of these transactions. So literally, at this point, $8.5 trillion worth of transactions cannot be tracked. And for some reason, Donald Rumsfeld decided to hold an entire press conference about this subject on Monday, September 10th, 2001. But for some reason, that didn't seem to make the headlines, because the next day, something else took over those headlines. A very interesting aspect of the story, and one that obviously continues to resonate today, and I think is one of those pieces of the puzzle that gives the big lie to Chapter 5 of the 9/11 Commission Report, which has one of the most stunningly, almost mind-bogglingly stupid statements that has ever been written in any government document. And I know that's a pretty big statement, because there's a lot of stupid statements in government documents. But in Chapter 5 of the 9/11 Commission Report, talking about the financing of the attacks, they actually say the U.S. government has not been able to determine the origin of the money used for the 9/11 attacks. Ultimately, the question is of little practical significance. That's a direct quotation from the 9/11 Commission report. The idea that anyone investigating culpability for a major crime like 9/11, it was a crime, let's keep that in perspective, anyone charged with investigating that, who would say, we don't know exactly how they got the money for this, we don't know where the money went or what kind of flow these funds did, but it doesn't matter, is being so disingenuous that it is, one would have to check their pants to make sure they're not on fire. It is, I mean, it's just on its face ludicrous, and flies, of course, directly in the face of that old maxim, follow the money. If you want to know who really did a crime, follow the money. That's the age-old adage, and
yeah,
yet for some reason,
yeah,
and for some reason they decided to completely ignore that for 9/11, probably because I would assume that is an uncomfortable question in a lot of different ways, including, as we've just talked about, those trillions of dollars in missing transactions that got covered up by an event like 9/11.
Well, it may lead to the real perpetrators. I mean, follow the money, you know.
That's
what they don't want you to go on that trail at all. And for them to even write that, it was unbelievable. I've heard that, you know, many times in other documentaries that people just can't believe. And that's the other thing. I think that the 9/11 Commission had to be a unanimous decision. So however many board members they had, if anybody had an objection about something, well, they would just leave that out. It's amazing that got left in.
Yes. And in fact, I believe it was 6 of the 10 9/11 commissioners have expressed their own doubts or problems with the commission itself, including Kane and Hamilton, the commission co-chairs, who said that they were set up to fail, which should be one sign that this is not going to be a particularly thorough investigation. There were complaints about the government minders, that anyone who was debriefed by the 9/11 commission, who was involved with the government in any way, had to have basically minders there to tell them what they could or could not say, or to stop them if they were going to say something that was, you know, classified or inappropriate or what have you. So in addition to 9/11 commissioners who stated on video that 9/11 was a 30-year conspiracy, but of course that was a citizen journalist who got that quote out of the that particular 9/11 commissioner. It was not a mainstream news channel, and of course no news channel has ever followed up to ask, what do you mean by 30-year conspiracy, and things of that nature. Again, those types of things pile up over the years, and perhaps any one or two of them could be explained away, but when you've got a majority of the commission itself who have expressed doubts in various ways about the commission's own findings, one has to wonder what on earth it is that they think that the 9/11 commission really actually exposed or detailed. And of course the answer is that basically it was a cover-up, and it was I believe someone did the actual math on the chapters that were primarily concerned with the narrative of the development of the plot. And I believe it was 3/4 of that of those chapters, the footnotes ultimately ended up sourcing torture testimony that was extracted by the CIA under torture of a few of these key individuals like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who also admitted to masterminding a plot to blow up a building that didn't even exist by the time he was captured, and other such interesting things like that. So this torture testimony was used for much of the 9/11 commission. And of course, the details of those torture sessions were destroyed when the CIA deliberately actually went out and defied a court order and destroyed the tapes of some of the torture sessions that they had on record, again in direct defiance of a court order not to do so. And ultimately no one ended up going to jail for that. No one was even reprimanded for that. The CIA just got away with it because, hey, it's the CIA, they can do anything they want. So I mean, the idea that the 9/11 commission was in any way a commission that was set up to find any details of any sort that actually led to the perpetrators of the crime is on its face one that we have to reject forcefully. And unfortunately, a lot of the public still continues to believe that the 9/11 commission was a thorough accounting for this crime, when, of course, I think, I hope infamously, the 9/11 commission was funded less than the inquiry into Monica Lewinsky and that whole scandal. There was less funding for the 9/11 commission than for a scandal like that, which shows, again, what the real priority there was, which was to get something on the record and basically sweep a lot of things under the rug.
Yeah, now, many times anyone starts to investigate what is the real truth in this, alarm bells go off and red flags go off. And when you hear that George Bush was asked to testify, he said, well, I'm not going to go there. I'll go meet them for lunch. I think that was one quote. And then later on, he said, well, I'm going to go there with Dick Cheney, but it'll be off the record. I mean, what do you mean off the record when you're going there to testify to a commission? I mean, that was another thing that set, you know, real red flags off for me, was like, you mean they're not going to tell the truth, and they're not going to be under oath? And if that guy's the president, who's in charge?
Exactly right. And there are so many different ways that we can look directly at President Bush's own connections to the attack in various ways, including, of course, the fact that Stratesec was featured on its board, a couple of people who are connected to Bush quite directly, one being his brother, Marvin Bush, and another being a distant relative, but someone who was also connected in with the Bush family, Wirt Dexter Walker III, who was specifically named in an FBI briefing reporting to the 9/11 Commission as one of the subjects of their 9/11 insider trading investigation. I believe on September 6th of 2001, Walker and his wife bought 56,000 shares of Stratesec, which was a company that provided various security services for different groups, including not only Dulles Airport, but United Airlines and the World Trade Center. So we see just what a startling job they did on 9/11 itself, not finding the supposed hijackers and their supposed box cutters that supposedly brought down the most sophisticated air defenses in the world. But so Stratesec failed miserably on that day. But unfortunately, this is not the real world where you would expect a company like that to stocks to drop after such a signal failure. Stratesec actually went up in price. The stocks ballooned in price after 9/11 because, well, of course, airport security is going to be a hot commodity after an event like 9/11. And of course, Stratesec was one of those companies that was positioned to benefit from that. So as a direct result of that, the Walkers, who made their purchase just a few days before 9/11, ended up profiting to the tune of something around the range of $50,000 from that purchase, which, again, isn't a startling amount of money, but it was specifically listed by the FBI as a suspicious transaction that came up in their investigation. But they decided not to investigate that because their investigation into Walker, which didn't even include an interview, they didn't even knock on his door to ask him about it. They just looked into his background and found that there was, quote, no ties to terrorism or other negative information. So apparently he wasn't even worth talking to, wasn't even worth investigating. And that pretty much defines so many different aspects of the investigation, but specifically when it comes to the money trail and the 9/11 insider trading, the FBI, the SEC had already decided, I suppose, that Al-Qaeda, as we've been told, this was some sort of, you know, regimented organization with a payroll and whatever else, almost like a corporation, that myth of Al-Qaeda was used as, well, these guys were the ones that perpetrated the crime, and thus anyone who could be found to be involved in these suspicious trades before 9/11 who was not directly connected with Al-Qaeda, well, they're not worthy of investigation, which is funny because, in fact, Wirt Walker III was also on the board of the Carlyle Group, which did have direct dealings with the Bin Laden family. So even there, there were reasons to suspect Wirt Walker, even if we were going with the official story. But it just, again, goes to show that this was not an investigation. It was a cover-up, and it was being directed by people like Kane and Hamilton, who had their own interesting connections to various parts of this day and what was going on there, including an interesting one with Commissioner Kane, who in the 1980s had a real estate transaction that he benefited from to the tune of $24 million with a group called BMI, which ended up being an investor in a small Massachusetts software company called P-Tech that a lot of people haven't heard of, but was very much involved in pretty much every agency that had anything to do with the response to 9/11. P-Tech was a software firm, as I say, based out of Massachusetts, started in 1994, and within just a few years had garnered a client list that was a who's who of Washington. It included the FBI, the IRS, NATO, Air Force, Naval Air Command, Department of Energy, Department of Education, Postal Service, U.S. House of Representatives, Department of Defense, Secret Service, the White House, and a list of blue chip corporate clients as well. And they were involved in enterprise architecture software, which is a type of software which provides a sort of God's eye view of a corporation and infrastructure, including not just the personnel, not just the materials involved in that organization, but all of the processes, the systems, the transactions, how they all relate to each other, so that you can really see everything that's going on with an organization in real time. And the promise of this software, and I use the word promise advisedly for people who know about the PROMIS software that was developed in the 1970s, but the promise of this software is that it could not only give you that kind of real-time view of everything happening in an organization, but equipped with the appropriate artificial intelligence, this type of software could actually help you to identify things before they happen. They could identify suspicious activity that are leading up to, for example, an insider trade or something of that sort, and allow you to intervene in real time to stop that from happening. Very interesting, very cutting-edge technology for its time. And so in 2001, the chief risk management officer of JP Morgan, obviously one of the largest financial institutions in the world, was looking at ways to implement risk management, cutting edge risk management software. She looked into PTEC, this software company that had its ties back in history to Kane, Commissioner Kane of the 9/11 Commission. She started to discover from her contacts, from her research, that this company included a bunch of people of very questionable origins, including this Yasin al-Qadi, who was a Saudi Arabian businessman, philanthropist, quote unquote, who has been reported as a billionaire, and by some people, his actual net worth is not known, but obviously a very wealthy person, who apparently provided $5 million of the initial $20 million of capital to get PTEC off the ground, which is interesting because Yasin al-Qadi not only liked to brag of his relationship with Dick Cheney, but he also was placed on the Department of Treasury's globally designated specially designated global terrorist watch list in October of 2001 for his suspected ties to funding terrorists, including bin Laden and al-Qaeda. So that investigation ultimately came to nothing, but because in December of 2002, PTEC's offices were raided, eventually, finally, after people like Indira Singh at JP Morgan and people in the Boston field office of the FBI and others were blowing the whistle on this, trying desperately to blow the whistle on PTEC and the fact they had inside access to all of these government agencies' computer systems. But the same day of the raid, which PTEC was warned about 2 months in advance, the White House press secretary and the Department of Homeland Security's governor at the time, Tom Ridge, both declared, no, nothing wrong. PTEC's okay. There's nothing wrong with this software. Now, the interesting part of this is that one of the things that they were specifically working on at the time of 9/11 were interoperability issues between the FAA and NORAD that would take place in the event of an aircraft emergency over U.S. airspace. So all of the systems that deal with the communication between FAA and NORAD and how those systems work together and how a response would be coordinated between those two agencies, that was one of the things that was specifically contracted in PTEC's contract with those agencies that they were working on. So as Indira Singh puts it, PTEC was in the basement of the FAA working on those issues on 9/11. On the very day when you had all of these anomalies going on related to the ghost planes that were showing up on these radars, including the ghost American Airlines Flight 11, which the NORAD was tracking for at least 20 minutes after the plane hit the tower, and they were still tracking a phantom Flight 11. And that's just one of the very many radar anomalies that were taking place that day that could have very well had something to do with the fact that this very shady company had access, backdoor access to all of these things. And Michael Rupert of From the Wilderness at the time was saying that his speculation was that Dick Cheney was running a version of PTEC in the PEOC, the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the bunker under the White House, on the morning of 9/11, directing the response, or misdirecting the response, as it may be, in terms of the air response to that day.
Yeah, Mike Rupert did some really good work back then, and he went on tour from city to city. I was lucky enough to see him in Vancouver, where he discussed that, and it was about, as I recall, like a four-hour lecture. I mean, we got 2 hours into it, and he said, okay, I've just given you the background. Now I can really talk about it. We're going to take an intermission, and we'll get back into it. And I had brought a friend of mine who was not really into all this political research along. He's like, what the hell? You know, what did you, you know? Now that was just the preamble to it, but it is that complicated for the uninitiated, and even for the initiated, like I was making a reference to Operation Northwoods, if you didn't know someone was directing these kind of things, you just wouldn't believe it. I mean, the average layman cannot fathom that the attacks could be directed from, you know, in the bunker, like you say, wherever Cheney was there, and he's orchestrating it. Now, I guess I don't know how you can answer this question I'm going to ask anyway, but other than maybe give a background, a brief to your 5-minute clip, but I was going to ask you, what do you think happened? What do you think happened on 9/11?
Well, obviously, that is, I mean, that is an overwhelming question, and one that I, anything that I say with regards to this is going to be based partially on speculation and partially on things that cannot be known from our perspective. So it should be taken with a grain of salt, like anyone else's answer to this question. And that's, and
let me just, before you mention that, you mentioned Mike Rubert, because I thought he did good work on it. But the other thing that did come out a couple of years later was Fahrenheit 9-1-1. And that Michael Moore was the first time people were talking about Saudi Arabia, the Saudi Arabians being protected, guards on the Saudi embassy. And Mike Rupert was one of the first people to say that, you know, the Bin Laden family were rounded up and flown. And when every other plane was grounded, they picked up the Bin Laden family and flew them out of the country. I mean, relatives, right? That was another flag. I mean, alarm bells. You got to be kidding me. Another one of those moments, right? So, you know, the government story is so unbelievable that when people talk about, well, what do you think happened? I mean, it reminds me, you know, personally of Operation Northwoods. I think that the Chinese weren't biting. The Russians had ended their Cold War. There was just nothing left. There was no real reason for this gigantic funded industrial military complex to go on. They needed an enemy. I think they needed a stateless enemy. And with all the war games and things and scenarios they must have gone through, they go, well, a stateless enemy means that the war will never be over, and we'll ramp up our military funding, which was black budget anyway. Like you mentioned, $8 trillion unaccounted for, $8 trillion. They have no idea where the money is.
Yes, it's head scratching, unless you know, of course, that the whole point is to create that big giant honeypot that is absolutely, it's a black budget that they can dip into as needed. And that shouldn't really be surprising to people who know about the history of the deep state and going back, of course, to the creation, the formal creation anyway, of the invisible government with the National Security Act in 1947 that created an unaccountable institution within the government itself. And again, this is maybe 9/11 wasn't a 30-year conspiracy. Maybe we could say it's a 60, 70-year conspiracy, maybe even further back than that. But if you want to look at the big picture. But yes, I mean, we can certainly see who benefited from these attacks. And as I say, people can look back at National Security Presidential Directive 9, NSPD 9, the first major foreign policy presidential directive, security directive of the Bush administration, which was the invasion plan for Afghanistan, ready to go 1 week before 9/11 took place, just to show one aspect of that. And of course, another key aspect that has to be mentioned, the Project for a New American Century, co-signed by that featured a who's who of the Bush administration, including, of course, Cheney and Wolfowitz and Pearl and the big names in what ended up becoming the travesty of the Bush administration, having signed the document Rebuilding America's Defenses the year before 9/11. So in September 2000, they put out a document saying that in order to modernize the military and sort of justify the expense that was needed in order to transform the military into a 21st century machine for projecting American power across the world for another century, there would need to be a catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. And I hope that phrase is infamous by now, because, of course, what was 9/11 referred to from the very day of the attacks, it was referred to as our new Pearl Harbor. And lo and behold, 9 months after coming into office, the Bush administration had already managed to create the exact thing that they had been arguing for in policy papers the year before. So I think it's quite obvious to see who benefited from this in ways like that in order to get the big picture of this. And as you say, I think Operation Northwoods is extremely important to understanding that this type of operation has, in fact, been planned in the past. It was not signed by JFK, thankfully, but it was approved all the way up through the Joint Chiefs of Staff and waiting to go sign to be signed by the president in order to happen, to stage terrorist events in Washington, D.C., including an event to commandeer a plane to use a remote control plane and blow it up over Cuba and blame the Cubans on it. Again, just incredible things. They're in black and white in declassified documents that anyone can go and read for themselves and ponder the significance of. So all of that is preamble. Again, in terms of what I think actually happened minute by minute in 9/11, there's so much supposition.
Well, yeah,
I don't mean that.
You know, I meant in a 5 minutes. So I'm going to make a link to your video, and I urge everyone to watch that, because that is basically a very good summation. I mean, you go rather quickly in it, though. And, you know, like, yes. Even like just talking about the hijackers, and then you find out that six of them or so are still alive, or now the you know their identities and passports have been stolen, and they, I mean, it's unfathomable that the 9/11 Commission just let that slide. They say, well, we don't really know who was on the plane.
Well, the official story on that was that, yes, there were various mainstream outlets, including the BBC, that had identified hijackers that appeared to continue still be alive. There were people claiming that, no, that's me, and I'm not dead, and things of that nature. That was being reported in the wake. But the Pentagon went and looked back at some of the records, including records of people who had attended, I believe, the Defense Language Institute. Had been identified as, oh, these are the hijackers, is the same name. And the Pentagon ultimately came out with some spokesmen to say, no, we looked at our records, and although some of the details were similar to the hijackers, some of them were different. These were different people. And that's pretty much the extent of the official explanation we ever got, that, yeah, there might have been some similar names, but these weren't the same people. Which is, again, I mean, as if we're supposed to simply take a Pentagon spokesman's word for that, and without any details whatsoever about what details were the same, what details were different, how did that get reported, and why, and all of those things. So again, I'm not sure whether or not the supposed alleged hijackers are actually alive at this point, but certainly there does seem to have been some identity theft that was involved in the creation of these characters for this hijacking, and that has obviously never been looked into. But to the extent that we do know about the official story of these hijackers and where they got, for example, their visas to enter the United States, we know that a large majority of them were issued at the Jeddah consulate in Saudi Arabia, which just happens to be the very consulate where a former consular official, Michael Springman, was in the 1980s involved in approving or disapproving visas for various people who wanted to visit the United States. And he noticed the phenomenon. There were quite a lot of people who came with very little or inadequate or even no documentation whatsoever about the nature of their trip or why they wanted to go to the United States. So he rejected their request, as was part of his job. And that was overruled by people in the consulate that turned out, of course, to be CIA officials working in the consulate. And he was able to find out eventually that these were the people that were being brought into the United States for training because they were our boys in Afghanistan back when the Afghan-Russian war was going on, people who were connected to Osama bin Laden and the Al-Kifar group in New York and things of that nature that were being literally brought into the United States as part of an intelligence operation. That was the very consulate that they were using back in the 1980s to do that. Just a few months before 9/11, the U.S. instituted a new fast-track program, visas, handing out visas like candy, where you didn't even need to visit the consul in order to get your visa. And there were several of these alleged hijackers who got their visa through that method. So Michael Springman has written an entire book on this, Visas for Terrorists, which I think is essential reading. I hope people do find out more about that story, because it's just another ridiculous part of this story. Sorry, I should correct myself. Visas for Al-Qaeda is the name of his book. But again, a fascinating part of this story, and one that again goes to show that anything that we've been told about these alleged hijackers came essentially from that first 24, 48, 72-hour window where we learned basically the names, and we were shown this photo of this collection of 19 photos, and that's basically the extent of the knowledge that the general public has of these alleged hijackers and where they came from and what we're supposed to know about them. But the story is obviously much, much deeper than that.
Yeah, and that's just one segment, you know, spoke of a wheel of like 20, you know, who were the hijackers, right? Well, they're not who we thought they were. To what extent did they even knew what they were doing, right? You know, they're getting funded. Who's supplying the funding? That wire transfer of, was it $200,000? You know, to make sure that the, I mean, it's like
a wire transfer from Mahmoud Ahmed, or apparently an FBI investigation, as reported in the, I believe, the Times of India at the time, found that wire transfer was initiated by Mahmoud Ahmed, the head of the ISI, which of course is the Pakistani CIA, and it's not just the Pakistani equivalent of the CIA. The ISI has, I think, quite famously been involved with the CIA since the 1980s and their involvement in the Afghan-Russian war. And the ISI was used to funnel the funds from the United States to the group that ultimately became Al-Qaeda. So, of course, there's that linkage. Now, the interesting part about that story is that Mahmoud Ahmed, again, the head of the ISI, was in Washington on September 11th, 2001. And on the morning of 9/11, while the planes were being steered into the towers by hijackers or by remote control, they're involved in a breakfast meeting with Mahmoud Ahmed were Bob Graham and Porter Goss, the heads of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees that ultimately produced the initial 9/11 inquiry before the 9/11 Commission, the Joint House Investigation. And that's an interesting story in and of itself, but also because now Bob Graham is one of these people that are going on mainstream news and anywhere else to talk about the missing, the redacted 28 pages from that report, the joint inquiry report, which of course places it all of the blame back on Saudi Arabia. At least that's what we're led to infer about those redacted 28 pages. So I am quite skeptical about Bob Graham and anything that he has to say about it, especially because of course, his relations with someone like Mahmoud Ahmed on the morning of 9/11, which of course has never been followed up or questioned by anyone involved in the mainstream media.
So you would be? Are you suspicious that anything he's saying then is going to be disinformation?
Well, I certainly do not expect that 9/11 truth is going to come to us through someone like Bob Graham, a career intelligence agent of one sort or another, and someone who, of course, was involved in the phony cover-up investigation after the attack. So I think that the 28 pages, I remember at the time when that was first talked about, when the joint inquiry came out with their report, I remember the 28 pages being talked about on mainstream news. I was in Canada at the time watching CBC, and they were talking about these redacted 28 pages and how it was Saudi Arabia. It talks about foreign involvement, including Saudi Arabia. So I don't know what the big mystery about this redacted 28 pages is. I mean, unless there is something else in there, but I think it quite obviously fingers Saudi Arabia. And I think that's more to do, the reason why this is being touted now probably has more to do with a geopolitical rift that's forming between Saudi Arabia and the United States as kind of the first cracks in the petrodollar regime that's undergirded the world monetary system for the last 40 years start to show. And I think this has to do more with a geopolitical contest than with anything about revealing the truth about 9/11. Because as I'm sure there is Saudi Arabian involvement, direct and indirect, in the 9/11 attacks and the setup of this, I certainly do not think that the cookie crumb trail ends there. And I'm sure it goes much deeper into the heart of the U.S. government, U.S. intelligence agencies, multinational corporations, foreign intelligence agencies like Mossad have their fingerprints all over this type of operation. So I suspect this as some sort of limited hangout that's now being kind of dangled in front of the public.
Yeah, it's strange to think that there's so many people involved in this, and you would think it'd be a small group, but yet it just, you know, you talk about the people who funded it, the Carlyle Group, Halliburton, and then if you watched a kind of obscure video, it's a one-man play, Who Killed John O'Neill. Are you familiar with that?
I am indeed, yes.
Yeah, you know, no, very strange, but that guy goes through his different personalities of doubting or being the investigator, and he's got like a big, well, it's not a chalkboard, but it's something on the wall with a whole bunch of post-it notes and string between them, and, you know, follow these connections. And we were talking earlier about follow the money, but yeah, all these people were going to make money over having America attacked and then buy Defense Department stock of all these different, you know, P-TECH you mentioned and other companies. And of course, everyone's familiar with Halliburton for sure, and the Carlyle Group to some smaller degree. But if you watched, you know, even picked up a little bit from Michael Moore's effort, that, you know, he said that's where the investigation should start.
Absolutely, yes. And just on that note, I think it is important for people who have only ever heard about this insider trading aspect of 9/11 and only heard about it in respect to put options on United Airlines and American Airlines before the attack. I think it's important to note that the investigation into the insider trading was much larger than that. The SEC actually investigated over 9.5 million different transactions spread across 103 companies, including 4 or 5 different options exchanges. And they cooperated with 10 foreign governments and all of this in their investigation, which then, of course, officially concluded there were no suspicious transactions. But take that for what it's worth. But it does go to show it was a much larger thing that they were looking looking at. And some of the companies that they were looking at were a lot of the companies that were directly affected, obviously, by the 9/11 attacks, including Marsh & McLennan or Munich Re, AXA, the AXA Group, some of the reinsurers who had to make large insurance payments to people like Silverstein, who, of course, ultimately profited from the attacks as well. And, of course, companies like Raytheon, whose stock shot up in the event of wake of that attack. So it wasn't just United Airlines and American Airlines. It was a much bigger financial transactions that were going on. And there have been not one, not two, but three different scientific papers that have come out since 2001, one in 2006, one in 2010, and one, I believe, in 2011, that all showed, yes, there was abnormal, unusual put option activity in the markets before 9/11, consistent with people trading on advanced knowledge of the attacks. And again, that's not some wild-eyed conspiracy theorist ravings. That is three separate scientific papers that have all concluded that, including in the Journal of Business and other pretty mainstream publications. So this isn't a disputed topic. The only thing is that the SEC ultimately concluded that the people who were involved in these trades had no conceivable link to terrorism, which, of course, is a bunch of baloney, because at the very least, as Michael Rupert pointed out at the time, one of the largest transactions that took place on United Airlines stock on September 10th was run through. It was a very strange order for 2,500 contracts that were split into five different orders, sent to all five major U.S. options exchanges and committed simultaneously, rather than going all through the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, which is the home exchange for United Airlines. They were split into five transactions and run through simultaneously. The person who brokered that particular transaction was Alex Brown, Deutsche Bank Alex Brown, which until 1998 was headed up by the executive director of the CIA on 9/11, Buzzy Krongard. And the connections just continue going down the rabbit hole from there. But it just, again, goes to give the lie to the idea that has seeped into the public consciousness that whole insider trading thing, that was researched and debunked. Of course it was not. And this is just another sign of the complete misinformation that's been given to the public on these subjects over the years. And unfortunately, as you say, it can take hours to elaborate on these types of things and to really get to nail down some of these points and these connections. And it starts to really overwhelm people, which is why it's so much easier to sell a lie than it is to sell the truth, because the lie is very easy. You can concoct a very simple narrative. Yeah, 19 men with box cutters got on planes and did this. And, you know, that's it. And it's so much more difficult to detail all of these different links.
Yeah, you mentioned how they got into the country and then what they were doing there down in Florida, flight schools and hanging out, drinking alcohol. I mean, they left their whole plans in the car in the parking lot, right?
Yeah, alongside their Koran. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they wouldn't have brought that with them.
Nope, just left it in the rental car for a nice trail for investigators. Yeah. This is the type of lunacy we're expected to take at face value, along with passports that float down into the lap of the New York City Police Department.
Yeah, and then the fact that a name that I wasn't really too familiar with, Bin Laden, all of a sudden everyone's going, well, it's got to be Bin Laden. You know, in one of the great documentaries, they make that quote well-known that, you know, George Bush saying it, and especially Rice, right? Well, we had no idea that, you know, anybody would be using planes to, you know, crash into buildings. And then the name of that report is, you know, terrorists suspected of using planes as weapons, and how are we going to react to that? That's not, you know, I'm paraphrasing, that's not the actual name of the report, but that if you recall that, right, that is...
Right, there was a Pentagon exercise, a FEMA exercise, a NORAD exercise, and an NRO exercise that all envisioned planes being used as missiles to slam into buildings. So there's four government agencies off the top of my head that had specific exercises that I linked up in the transcript for that 9/11 video. The official title for that video, by the way, is 9/11, a Conspiracy Theory, but it's been posted by under many different titles around the web, and I'm glad it has been so.
And then to underscore that is that very interesting episode of the spinoff from X-Files, the Lone Gunman, in which their opening episode, I think it was March or April of that year, 6 months ahead of time and just described a plane being flown right into the World Trade Center, one of the towers.
Yes, remote controlled, taken over by remote control and steered towards the World Trade Center in the hopes of starting a war with some tin pot dictator in the Middle East.
That's just begging to be carpet bombed.
Yes, exactly. In order to profit from the results of that. So yes, it pretty much what a lot of people in the 9/11 truth movement have come to allege right there in on the screen in just a few months before. And of course, one of the people who talked about that in the wake of that was one of the actors. I can't remember his name at this point. Yes, Dean Haglund. Is that right? No, maybe I'm making that up. Anyway, the actor who came out and said, yes, well, you know, Chris Carter got a lot of his ideas from CIA. So there you go. There's a pretty interesting lead for anyone who would like to follow that up in the mainstream media. I'm not going to hold my breath.
Yeah. Well, your 5-minute clip is very interesting. I urge everyone to watch that. And also, you've done a lot of shows on the things all surrounding. We talk about Operation Northwoods, where the government would do something, you know, so drastic as to, like a Reichstag fire, you know, blow up their own parliament buildings just to get people to sign up and then ram through the Patriot Act, you know. And in fact, even the name of that, the Patriot Act, right? And then George Bush going, you know, you're either with us or with the terrorists. You couldn't be neutral or even suspect that a lot of countries were. And that a lot of countries are now, you know, that that aren't ready just to jump on the bandwagon of America going into another. And in fact, this travesty, what's going on in Syria, I almost feel it's America's fault for going in there for the last since 2001. They've caused all that turmoil there. The whole region is a complete chaos, and it's not like it wasn't any more chaotic before, but you know, I don't want to get into the funding of ISIS and ISIL and whatever happened to the Taliban. They're our friend now, but I think it's very evident in Libya how they've just gone in and just caused chaos to make money out of that, because now with no one in charge, there's no one really to blame. And is Libya going to charge, you know, a new government of Libya going to charge America for going in there? Well, it's a whole Twilight Zone episode, the whole Middle East there anyway.
It certainly is, yes.
But are you able to give any kind of conclusion to what you think is going on? I mean, we've been talking about it around the thing that the intelligence community has needed funding. Seems that they need some kind of invisible enemy where there is no place you can go and plant a flag and say, okay, Blair, well, we've gone to the capital of a city like in World War II. We've gone to Berlin. We've captured Berlin. So the war is over. There's no real place you can go now in the Middle East and the Americans can go there, take that hill and plant the flag and say, okay, well, terrorism's over now. That's not
right, of course. Yes. No, it's the convenient boogeyman for the post-Soviet era. And it has been built up and consciously engineered as such since at least 1979 with Operation Cyclone under Carter. And, of course, at the time, the National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who went to Afghanistan during the Afghan-Russian War and gave stirring speeches about how you will win this fight because God is on your side, talking to the Taliban and the future members of this mythical Al-Qaeda organization. And we know about, obviously, American intelligence involvement in Afghanistan since the 1980s and with these Afghan Mujahideen and the Arab Afghans, as they were called, the nucleus of what became these Al-Qaeda fighters. And we know about that story. And unfortunately, the ISIS story and what's going on in Syria now is just a continuation of that story in many ways, including the fact that, of course, ISIS was previously Al-Qaeda in Iraq. For people who don't know about the story and the crazy insanity behind that story and the characters and the supposed leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, who was killed on multiple occasions, as reported by the mainstream press. if people who don't know about that story, I did a podcast on who is really behind ISIS about a year ago that looked in greater depth and detail about that. But I think the summarization of that is that, as has been the case for decades, really for upwards of a century, when we go back and look at the British, the dying British Empire and their use of the Muslim Brotherhood as a type of tool of empire, I think we're just seeing a continuation of that strategy where these radical Islamic groups are funded and fostered and aided into existence and stirred up as a type of basically a chess piece that can be moved onto any part of the chess board that is of military or geostrategic interest to the would-be planners and rulers of the world, that can destabilize that part of the chessboard so that they then have the excuse to go in and do whatever they want, as in Libya, for example, or Syria, or just, you know, name any of the major invasions or destructions of countries that we've seen in the last several years. And we're just seeing a continuation of that strategy. But again, I go into this in more detail in some of my other work.
I'll make a link to that for sure. But it reminds me about, you know, Afghanistan. There's nothing there but a pipeline route or poppy fields, you know, heroin, opium. So that's
and wouldn't you know it, poppy production has reached an all-time record high yet again. It just continues to happen year after year after year since the NATO invasion, after, of course, the Taliban almost completely eliminated the poppy crop. Well, that didn't last for very long, and now we're seeing record after record after record being reached. And the U.S. military admitting on Fox News to Geraldo Rivera, well, we have to go in and protect these poppy crops, because if we don't do it, then these people will turn to the Al-Qaeda. So it grinds our gears, it grinds in our gut, but we have to do it.
They'll sell it to Russia or the Chinese or someone else. So we better take it, right?
Exactly.
So therefore, we're protecting it. Yeah, that is actually a part of the real story there.
It's a huge part. And people who don't know about that should definitely check into the work of Peter Dale Scott, who's done so much of the yeoman work on that issue for decades now.
Right. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to wrap up a little bit here with urge people to check out some of your other archives. I'll make a link to a couple of those ones you mentioned. And that five-minute clip you did that I think summarizes the absurdity of the official story of 9/11 and what happened. What happened? It's impossible that it happened the way it happened. I don't believe the buildings fell unaided, both of them. And the Pentagon...
You mean all three of them?
Well, yeah, right. I meant all three. But just when... I didn't know about Building 7 for quite a while either later on. You know, it was like, I think, months until a documentary came out to say what was wrong with 9/11. And because I may have been a bit doubting of the official story, I would start to watch these things, you know. I mean, you know, even as late as a couple of years ago, Jesse Ventura did a couple of shows on that. But otherwise, there's been nothing, you know. Like there's been a lot of these quasi-documentaries that show up on, you know, on major networks that say, well, it was just unfortunate. It's unfortunate that such an attack happened and no one was fired. No one chastised. Nothing, you know. I mean, you can't believe that the Defense Department could fail so badly and only send up two fighters and send them then off. I mean, it's unbelievable, really. And yet, you know what happened. You know that this is what they allowed to happen. And then you start to add in the 7/7 bombing and the training exercises that are happening the same day. And you go, are we seeing this again? Is this a blueprint?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think obviously as if we look at 9/11 as nothing other than a psychological operation, it certainly was more than that. But we can look at it as a psychological operation that was directed towards the public precisely for the reason that you mentioned earlier, the passage of the Patriot Act and the justification of militarization and the war in Afghanistan and all of that. It worked stunningly well. And there was overwhelming support for that agenda in the immediate wake of the attacks, because as you pointed out towards the beginning of this conversation, it was a very weird and destabilizing time for so many people. And we have to remember the context of that time as well, that it wasn't just 9/11 happened and everything that we know about it today is what we knew at that time. It was still a developing story. There were still a lot of questions about what was happening and what was to come. And there was a great sense of fear in the general public at that time about follow-up attacks that were being talked about on the nightly news every single night. And then, of course, it was just a few weeks later that we had the anthrax attacks that, again, provided a convenient justification for the new war on terror boogeyman narrative that they were trying to unfold, even though we know now 100% it is fully admitted, even by the FBI, that it did come from a U.S. military biological weapons production facility, or a biological production facility. Of course, it's not officially biological weapons. But yes, we know it was came from inside the U.S. government. The only question is whether it's the patsy that they tried to pin it on after his death, Bruce Ivins, or whether it was more likely someone else completely. But anyway, people who can think back to that time know that this was not just an event that took place. It was sort of the catalyst for a series of events that took place. And within that that psychological operation enacted on the public to condition them in the fear, within that context, we can see it was wildly successful. And unfortunately, that's a pattern that is the general pattern of false flag attacks. So when we look at events like 7/7, again, it's the continuation of that narrative and the reinforcement of that in the minds of the general public.
You know, I'm going to relay a little story to you that I haven't mentioned before, because when you were talking about psychological operation, it triggered another little memory that I was talking to some firefighters in Vancouver, Canada, and they said there was this big plea from all firefighters from around North America anyway, we're going to go to New York to help out. And they said, there was about 10 of them that came from Vancouver, New Westminster, wherever around here, and they went there. When they landed in New York, he said, there was all these police and firefighters that were there to greet them. The streets are blocked off and they had escorts. They had like these motorcycles and trucks all escorting these people to the attack site, you know, ground zero. He kind of commented, he said he couldn't believe how many people came from every other place, you know, like Kansas City or wherever, you know, they all came there. But trying to emphasize that the amount of people that there were there, like on the sidelines, escorting these people to there, and that, you know, not that there was that many New York firefighters there, but there was like, you know, triple the amount of numbers from out of state, out of country kind of thing. And it made me think about, well, this is just like almost an organized public relations thing, and yes, you know, a psychological operation. Get everybody from as far away as you can, get in here, let them do the digging, find a few bodies, and then say thank you, and then send them back home. The amount of people that they said it's safe here and don't worry about anything.
Exactly.
And,
yes,
you know,
you see, that's really one of the most disgusting aspects of this. You're right that these people were used more or less as convenient living stage props for this psychological operation. I mean, genuine grief and mourning that the public was going through being put on TV and made into this spectacle so that we can all take part in this national grieving that helped to forward the narrative. But of course, at the exact point at which it was no longer convenient or interesting for them to engage in that spectacle, all of these real living human beings were discarded by the wayside, as shown with the disgusting treatment of the 9/11 responders, and the fact that, of course, many of them are dying at this point from their ailments that were received as a direct result of the exposure that they had to all of the dust at Ground Zero, which, as people should remember, I hope they remember, Christine Todd Whitman, the head of the EPA at the time, just in the days after the attack, said, no, it's okay, Ground Zero is all right, it's safe to breathe, which was a knowing and deliberate lie that is still costing people their lives. And again, you have people like Giuliani, who let the firefighters onto the pile to help dig through the rubble, but as soon as they discovered some of the missing gold, well, they kicked a lot of the firefighters off the pile. And to this day, firefighters hate Giuliani. That was one of the big things when he was running for president, was the firefighters detested Giuliani because he did kick them off the pile, used the NYPD to get the New York Fire Department off the pile in October, after they discovered some of the missing gold from the basements of World Trade Center. So again, these people are just props to be used. And at the point at which their grieving is no longer amenable to the narrative, they will be discarded by the wayside, like so much of the trash that was thrown out that day.
Yeah, can you elaborate just a little more about that? Because I understand there were like armored cars and dump trucks that were used to transfer shuttle gold and a lot of money back and forth between all of the World Trade Center buildings. You know, that's something that I don't think I've seen much in the mainstream press at all.
No. There was a bit of reporting at the time, but not a lot. And I've covered this perhaps most notably in a podcast I did. It was called What Happened to the WTC Gold on 9/11. So I'll point people to that, where I have all of the documents listed there. So I won't try to go off of memory on a lot of that information. But basically, yes, I mean, we do know there were vaults under WTC-4, for example. There was a vault. And we do know that there was reports of a cache of gold found at WTC, basically two truckloads that were received through a tunnel in rubble. There was reports of that at the time. I think some of those reports are spurious when you start to look into them and what they really mean. But there is, we have to keep in mind, again, the World Trade Center site is right next to the vaults of the Federal Reserve of New York as well, which is the largest repository of gold that we know about in the world, or one of them anyway. So there's a lot of different aspects to what was potentially also taking place in the tunnels underneath the World Trade Center complex and in the vaults underneath there while these attacks were going on. And I think an interesting little insight on that for people who are, like your friend back at the Michael Rupert conference, not so interested in geopolitics and these types of things, just watch something like Die Hard 3, where there was a staged terrorist event in order to distract people from a gold heist going on in the vaults of the New York Federal Reserve Bank. An interesting little scenario that may have, to some extent, actually played out on 9/11 itself.
Yeah, I recall what you're talking about. Yeah, that's I found that of interest. There's another one, Operation Swordfish. I always wanted to talk to the writer of that script, you know, who wrote that. That's a very interesting one. I don't know if you recall that one.
I'm unfamiliar with that one.
Well, we'll get into that another time. But it's another thing where you go, where do these guys get these ideas from? And it seems that if you follow them back, that they, like, with Chris Carter, and that somebody says, hey, you know what, they've gotten the works here. Here's a little war game scenario that we have going on. And that would make an interesting movie. I'll write a script around that. I'll develop that, you know. So all people have got to do is just leak something and, like you say, start this diversion to cause a fire over here so you can raid the hen house. People won't be looking over there, but with 9/11, it's really so tragic. Yes. To the loss of...
And I would like to say that I don't think that there is any one motive for all of this. I think an event like 9/11 on the scale of 9/11, I think, took place for a number of different reasons. So I wouldn't posit that it was simply a gold heist or anything of that sort, but obviously with an operation of that scale, there would be a lot of different people from a lot of different angles that would benefit from different ways. So you would expect there to be various operations going on, like in the JFK assassination. Again, there's a lot of different people whose interests converged at seeing JFK dead, which is part of the reason why it happened. I don't think there's one identifiable explanation that you can pinpoint as the only or the primary, or maybe there is a primary explanation, but there's a lot of secondary things that happened at the same time. And just like Al Capone being taken down for tax evasion, perhaps it's one of those secondary events or operations or sub-operations that might be a key into uncovering the larger plot.
Yeah, I think with the case of JFK, he had so many enemies. And they were so powerful that they all reacted. It's been described as the apex of an hourglass, so that the top half is everything before had. And then when he's killed, everybody says, okay, that's for the better. We're back in operation. We're going into Vietnam. We're starting, the CIA's going back full bore. You know, all this bloomed again under Johnson and further. A different topic, so we'll
but
leave
don't
that.
Don't worry, Alan Dulles is heading up the Warren Commission. It'll all uncover if there's anything untoward going on there, right?
Yeah, I enjoyed your episode about Alan Dulles as well. I had interviewed the author of that latest book.
Stephen Kinzer, yeah.
Yeah, he seemed a little more neutral than I thought. I mean, I think you and your tone summed up Dulles very appropriately.
Yes, especially. I think Kinzer did some great work exposing certain aspects of Dulles and his story, but
he did
not go far enough.
Yeah, he did, but he didn't seem to be affected. He didn't really, I think that maybe me and you would go, aha, I knew he was that rotten, Dulles, and even further. It's a kind of, when you land in Washington, D.C., and you land at Dulles Airport, you feel that power, you know, like, wow, he must have, you know, it's like Hoover, the FBI building, whatever, you know, regardless of what you think of him, there's somebody flexing a lot of power. And when they're naming the airport after you, Dulles, right? But it seems to have been eroded, and he's not held with the same high esteem that was at a different time. The fact that Kennedy fired him, that could be, you know, the thing. Well, you know what? I've got a lot of friends in D.C., and one of us has to go. I'll make sure it's you. So Kennedy's removed, and then, you know, Alan Dulles appointed to the commission by LBJ, you know, maybe showing his patronage. Okay, Alan, you know, you're back in the game here. I'll give you something to do. But back to 9/11, is there anything that you would wrap up with that would be a conclusion? Because I don't want to press you too hard, but I know there's some other theories where people say, well, we don't believe it happened. There's holograms or projections or there's a lot of weird ideas that people have other than just looking at it and saying, well, follow the money. This is a psychological operation to make sure that this PNAC, the Carlyle Group, the Cheneys and all that, keep flex their muscles and show everybody, you know, guess what? We're gonna report a commission, and when the president and the vice president aren't even gonna go on oath. We're not even going, you know, and we're just gonna meet them for lunch. So that right there, I think, explains the power, you know, that yeah, you can have your commission, but we're not gonna tell the truth.
Yes. Well, on the subject of some of the more outlandish theories that get thrown around, I would say that if I was involved in crafting a operation like this, I would make sure to not only control the sort of mainstream narrative, but also to try to contain the alternative narrative. And I'm sure you've encountered that in your exploration of the JFK assassination and some of the false trails that are put out there for researchers. And I have no doubt there have been many, many false trails and false narratives that have been put out there in through the alternative media, or even in the alternative media. I'm sure there are people who are working for agendas that they are not open about. And unfortunately, again, I think the wonder and the beauty of the alternative media is that it's open to anyone. And of course, that's also a Trojan horse through which these kinds of false narratives can be put out very easily as well. So I think everyone has to keep that in mind and has to be very, very conscious of that fact at all times. So my ultimate take would be to say, I have no doubt there have been a lot of false narratives that have been sown and false cookie crumb trails to lead people down dead end paths. And the only way that we can sort this through, I don't think it's going to come from me or you or any other individual. I think it's going to come collectively. People are going to have to sort through this, and individually, everyone has to decide for themselves. And the only way we can do that is through actual evidence and documentary evidence as well. And so never, ever trust anything that I say. Anything that I say should have some sort of documentation to back it up if I make a statement of fact. And I hope people will follow that. That's why all of my work at CorbettReport.com is open source. I do put the links to all of the sources that I use in the construction of the reports, so people can go back and look at them themselves. And I think that's the important part of this. So don't take my word for anything, and don't simply just trust that I know what I'm talking about. Please do go back and check my references and check what I'm talking about. And I think, again, like myself and my own journey into this really started from me starting to look up things like Operation Northwoods and finding that for myself. I really think when people engage in the material in that manner, that it will start to be that type of revolution of consciousness that I think is ultimately important here. As much as actual justice for 9/11 and its real perpetrators is the ideal and is the ultimate goal, I think, unfortunately, given the state of the world today, it's extremely unlikely, and especially now 14 years after the events, increasingly unlikely that that's going to happen in a courtroom. I think the another important goal that we should be working towards is exposing this information so that we can convict the perpetrators in the public, the court of public opinion, which is could be equally important, because as we say, there was so much of the psychological operation to this that they were trying to influence people's understanding and emotions so that they could direct them towards this phony war on terror narrative. Well, if we can undermine that, then we've done a significant job in helping to undermine one of the goals of this operation overall. And I think that's something that we can all be working towards. And again, that's only going to come through hard work. I hate to say it. I know no one likes to hear that, but research is hard work, and it can take hours to explain any one aspect of this, and it requires a lot of documentary research and evidence to underlie that. So there's no shortcut, unfortunately, that I know of. I think people have to really engage in this material themselves, and that's basically my warning, because we know people can look at the documentary declassified documents that have come out about operations like COINTELPRO. The FBI was running back in the 50s and 60s to undermine opposition to the U.S. government by doing things like planting people in various groups and getting them to fight with each other and call them out as agents and all of that kind of nonsense that distracts people from the real issues at hand. So again, let's keep this focused on the actual evidence, what we can show, what we can't show, the reasonable suppositions we can make. And I think in that conversation that's going to happen collectively amongst us, I think we'll come closer to the truth than we ever can just trying to follow one or another person's individual opinions.
Okay, I thought maybe you were going to tell me you thought Dick Cheney was behind it and I could close the book on it.
I would be genuinely shocked if he was not involved in it, but the extent to which he was running it, I again, would be supposition.
Right. Well, James, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, doing some really good work. I'm going to make links in our show notes to everything that we've made note of and the Corbett Report. Before I wrap up, is there anything you wanted to get to maybe that I didn't bring up?
I think we've explored quite a bit of the different facets of this, and there's many, many other things we could talk about, like the history of the Patriot Act, for example, and things of that nature. But I've addressed a lot of these different aspects in some of my other work before, so I'll just direct people to CorbettReport.com for some of this information that I've worked on in the past, and also for a new podcast/documentary project I'm working on that I hope to have available for the 9/11 anniversary this year, specifically about the money trail. So some of those aspects we've been talking about today, 9/11 insider trading and the Pentagon missing trillions and some of those types of issues. So people can look for more sort of in-depth and some of those links to those source documents that I'm talking about in that documentary.
Right. And that's this Friday.
It will be available on YouTube and on my website.
Very good. Yeah, I generally talk about politics from, you know, Jack Kennedy assassination, Bobby Kennedy, Martin Luther King. But I did want to bring up 9/11 again and just talk about that this year for whatever reason. And I just thought, you know, I'd really enjoy talking to you about it and getting your insight and urge people to follow the money and follow your work at the Corbett Report.
Thank you very much, Lynn. It's a pleasure talking to you anytime.
All right. Thanks.